And now, an important message for all young men.
Does your self-esteem suffer from an embarrassing lack of hair? Do you feel less than a man when you remove your shirt?
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm Cy Sterling, president of the Chest Hair Club for Men. Our new patented system takes some of your extra hair and permanently implants it in your upper frontal torso. This painless procedure leaves you looking as natural as if Mother Nature herself had granted you a thick chest of hair.
That really hurts.
Best of all, it looks completely natural.
Ooh, just let me run my fingers through that thick mat of hair.
Okay. The Chest Hair Club for Men.
Hey, my ring is stuck.
Call now, One Hairy Chest.
Don't move.
And ladies,
okay.
Remember,
wait.
If electrolysis has ruined your life, there's the Facial Hair Club for Women.
Ow, my finger!
I'm sorry.
And remember, I'm not only the president, I'm also a client.
Oh, yeah, that's the stuff.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this broadcast, we're listening to Lawrence Wright talk about his latest book, which is a report on the Church of Scientology. And at this point, he's relating to how various celebrities managed to identify with the Church of Scientology.
But the big fish, the one that would be the transforming figure, eluded capture. The biggest fish was John Travolta. And his is an exemplary story in itself. He was a young and a troubled young actor who was doing his first movie in Mexico. And he became friends with an actress, and she decided to give him a copy of Dianetics. She was in Scientology herself, and she gave him some Dianetic therapy, and he went exterior. He had an out-of-body experience. This really made a huge impression on him. And then when he came back to Los Angeles, he started taking courses at the Celebrity Center. And one day he told his teacher that he was trying out for a role in Welcome Back, Kotter. And so the teacher had everybody in the class, if you can imagine you're the class, orient themselves towards ABC Studios and telepathically send the message, John Travolta is right for the part. And he got the part. So after that, he always said that Scientology put him in the big time. I have some concerns about, as Travolta brings up a story that I think is also an important one to understand. One of my sources is a delightful woman named Spanky Taylor. She joined the church when she was a young teenager, and because of her charm and her bubbly nature, she was assigned to help young actors. And one of the young actors was John Travolta, who was just beginning to have this burst of fame, and it was hard for him to handle. And Spanky helped him through that emotional, difficult period. And his mother died, and you know he really leaned on her. Now, Spanky had a little girl, and she was pregnant. And a friend of hers was dying, and she felt that the church wasn't taking good care of her, and she got angry, and she was sent to this RPF thing in this old hospital that's on the edge of Hollywood, a big blue building that many of you have seen with a big yellow sign of Scientology on it that looms over the district. It's an old hospital, as I said, and there were so many people crowded into the old patient rooms by the dozen that Spanky was put up on the roof with a soggy mattress. I mean, she's pregnant. She's eating slop out of a bucket. She's in Hollywood. She's, you know, look around. You can see Sunset Boulevard and all this sort of thing. Just imagine the contrast. And her baby is taken from her to a Scientology child care place where there's only one woman overlooking dozens of children. At one point, Spanky went over to see her baby, Vanessa, and Vanessa had whooping cough, and her crib was soaking wet, and her eyes were glued shut with mucus, and Spanky thought she could die. Moreover, since she was pregnant and she was losing weight, she thought she'd lose her baby as well. So she was really, really scared. And at this point, members of the church came to her and asked if she could get a print of Saturday Night Fever from Travolta. And the deal was, you know, she agreed to call Travolta's assistant. And he said he would give her the print. It was the only copy left. It was his personal copy. But the deal was she had, you know, he hadn't heard from her for months, and he didn't know what was wrong with her, but I think he must have suspected. He said, the deal is I want to have dinner with you. So, okay, the Scientology executives agree to the deal, they get the print, they show the movie, and then she's taken and forced to call Travolta and break the date. And he sent her flowers that were taken up to her in the RPF. But I have to say, what did he know? What did he know about his friend who had taken care of him? She finally made an escape, calling Travolta's assistant to come pick her up as she was going to supposedly take her daughter for medical treatment, and then she jumped in the car and fled. But I still wonder, you know, when people like John Travolta and Tom Cruise and others stand up and say what a great place Scientology is, if they remember those occasions, if they acknowledge the kind of abuses that are taking place right under their noses.
Hi. Thank you for being here. You're fascinating. I love your writing.
Thank you.
My question is twofold. Number one is, why aren't there any police reports, like this other woman asked about,
yeah,
all the abuse? When people get on the freeways, they take their passports away, so they don't have any money, they can't escape, they have nowhere to go. There was a show on TV this week about a pregnant woman who was forced to actually live in a parking garage while she was pregnant.
Yeah.
Why don't these people, after they defect, why don't they report this? And number two, why do people stay even though they're mistreated?
Well, these two questions are tied together. And let me put you in the mind frame of someone who, say, someone who has been abused on this gold base in the desert compound. And it could be that you, if you're that person, suppose you joined, like many of these people, when you were a child. Or maybe you were born into it. Let's say that probably, you know, many of your family members, maybe all of them, are members of the church. Your whole society is composed of people like you in the Scientology and probably in the Sea Org. And you don't have any education to speak of. You're impoverished. You're paid $50 a week. When you become a member of the Sea Org, you're given two shirts and two pair of pants, and that's your lifetime allotment. So everything that you, you know, all of your other needs, you know, come out of that money. So you don't have very much contact with the outside world. You're taught to be very suspicious of it. Non-Scientologists in Scientology are called WOGs. It's an old ethnic slur that the Brits had for South Asians, but Hubbard adopted it for non-Scientologists. And WOG justice is one of those things that you would never do. Now, if you say you've been physically abused, or some other reason would cause you to want to leave the church, you could go through the front door. That would mean turning your back on all of your family and friends into a society that you're very ill-equipped to go into. But if you did make that choice, you would also be given a bill. It's called a freeloader's tab. And it's a bill for all the services you might have been getting during that period of time or whatever else they want to add into it. And typically this is hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, your bank account probably is not that flush. And you're also made to sign a confession of crimes that you supposedly committed. And in case you ever say anything against the church, they'll have this document, as I've seen such documents, to be used against you. If you decide, on the other hand, to just simply run away, and you're able to get out of sight of the gate and actually escape, as a number of people I've talked to have been able to, they'll go after you and try to bring you back. And the ways, and I talked to the guy that was in charge of that, they call it a blow drill, it's really chilling. They're able to call airlines and persuade them that they are relatives and medical emergencies and find out what flight you're on. They'll send people out to sit outside your relatives' houses and monitor them. You know, it's out in the desert, so, you know, they usually get you before you get very far. But one guy, they know so much about you. You know, they got all your financial information, everything you have to confess. But one guy, what really got him is that he was well known for his love for baseball, and they picked him up in the San Francisco Giants parking lot. So you can see that this is a totalistic universe, and it's very difficult to break away.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
When the postman delivered a letter, it filled her dear heart full of joy. But she didn't know till she read the inside. It was the last one from her darling boy. Dear Mom, was the way that it started. I miss you so much, it went on. Mom, I didn't know that I loved you so, but I'll prove it when this war is won. I'm writing this down in a trench, Mom. Don't scold if it isn't so neat. You know, as you did when I was a kid, and I'd come home with mud on my feet. The captain just gave us our orders, and Mom, we will carry them through. I'll finish this letter the first chance I get, but now I'll just say I love you. Then the mother's old hands began to tremble, and she fought against tears in her eyes. But they came unashamed, for there was no name, and she knew that her darling had died. That night as she knelt by her bedside, she prayed, Lord above, hear my plea, and protect all the sons that are fighting tonight, and dear God, keep America free.
Yes, sir.
Let me unite two themes. One is follow the money, and the need for plaintiffs who are inside who want to bring suit. And just recently, a couple in names of Garcias filed suit in district court in Florida for fraud for $400,000, naming the various Scientology organizations as well as Miscavige by name this way, and supposedly with some contractual basis for their suit. Yeah, to what extent would this be a way for the organization to face a new reality, where it's not, you know, an individual simply trying to break free, but someone going after the money, something which is important to Scientology and Miscavige?
Well, as I said earlier, this is an organization that's really lawyered up. And I talked to one of the lawyers who created the architecture, the bureaucratic architecture of Scientology, and there's so many discrete compartments that it's impossible to break the bank. You know, each one of them is isolated from the other. And I met the Luis Garcia and his wife, and you know, I wish them well. But you know, I think it's a formidable task to take down Scientology. It has to take itself down. It has to, you know, somebody inside, there aren't really, the reason I take on the celebrities and assign them this responsibility is the other executives are so cowed and, you know, have been locked up for such a long periods of time, they have no power. The only power that anybody has in the Church of Scientology to really affect change are those front men that you constantly see. And they're the ones that I charge with changing that church.
How much fidelity is there in the portrayal in the movie The Master and the processes that go on in the church?
Well, I love The Master. A lot of people don't agree with me, and maybe it is very obscure, and maybe because of my reading so much of L. Ron Hubbard's works, it was more interesting to me than some. I thought the performances were really compelling. And I thought Philip Seymour Hoffman was a very plausible reincarnation of L. Ron Hubbard in many respects. And you could kind of see the charisma and the contradictions in his personality that make Hubbard such a charismatic and compelling figure, a really great figure to write about. There were actually bits of dialogue in the movie that are in my book, not that I wrote, but that someone else, you know, the resources that I used that turned up in the lips of some of the characters in that movie. So yes, there was fidelity in that way, but it's elusive. It doesn't intend to be an exact depiction of the Church of Scientology, but just the allure of powerful personality like that. Yes.
Are you aware of any meaningful, serious efforts to challenge the 501c3 exemption or maybe an aggressive state that's
no,
priority?
No, I am not.
My question is about a set of abuses or alleged abuses that you mention in your book. You say that the Scientology organization does not believe that its Sea Org leadership women should have babies, but it denies to you that it's ever pressured any pregnant woman to have an abortion. But your book also says that numbers of pregnant women have said to you and to others that they have been pressured by Scientology organization to have abortions that they didn't want to have.
Right.
So can you explain how specific are the allegations of the pressure on the one hand, and how specific are the denials as to the particular contentions, and have you drawn a conclusion?
Well, I've talked to a lot of women that said that they had abortions and that they were told to have abortions, and men who said their wives, you know, were pushed to have abortions. It's not just women that feel the loss. And some of those people are out now and will never have families. You know, they miss that opportunity. So it's a really tragic thing, but, you know, the leverage that the church uses, you know, it used to be there were children in Scientology. There used to be on board ship. They caused a lot of trouble. And Hubbard had a theory that children are not different from adults. They're just small. And therefore, they should be treated as you would treat an adult. And so when a child misbehaved, he came up with one of his punishments was to put them in the chain locker. That's where the anchor chain is stored. And it's cold and dark and dank, and they would be fed, but they were not allowed out to go to the bathroom or go to sleep or anything. And they were just put in there for days, and some of them for weeks. And he actually put a deaf girl down there to hope that she would regain her hearing. So the treatment of children became a huge issue early on, and finally it was decided we can't have them. We can't have kids here, because they had a ranch for children, and the children essentially built their own dormitories and gave themselves schooling and so on. Very, very little adult supervision. So it came to pass that the decision was made, no more kids, which meant that if you get pregnant, you have a choice. You can leave the Sea Org with all the consequences that I told you about, losing your ties to your families and so on, and having very little to look forward to, and the sense of losing your eternal salvation. Or you could watch out of the Sea Org and be sent off to some remote location as a staff member. In the face of that, a lot of people chose to have the abortion. And what they do is they go to county health in Riverside County and charge it to the taxpayers.
My question is whether the allegations of pressure to have the abortion or to get your wife to have the abortion? Are they specific? Do they mention time and place? And who's? And how about the denials? Are they specific that either that person was not in Scientology or the wife wasn't in Scientology or the person doing the pressure wasn't? Are they specific?
The allegations of the abortions are individual. Person by person, they, you know, women or husbands would tell me, you know, this happened to me, and there you see sometimes in court suits where they've specified dates like that. The church's response is categorical: we don't do that. You're welcome.
I've read a couple of your articles and another book about Scientology. Looking forward to reading your book in whole. But Miscavige comes across as a terribly malevolent figure, including the way he pushed his way to leadership. But my question is, has he really denatured Scientology in an evil way, or is what he's doing very much a follow-on from the principles instilled by L. Ron Hubbard?
Well, David Miscavige and L. Ron Hubbard are different in one way, which is that David Miscavige grew up in Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard did not. You can't say that David Miscavige is not a creation of Scientology because he joined it when he was a young teenager. He joined the Sea Org when he was 16 after dropping out of high school. His entire adult life and most of his entire life has been lived inside this organization. So he is a manifestation of it. Many ex-members think that he has taken the church away from the original teachings of L. Ron Hubbard. Every religion faces an existential moment when the founder dies. And whether it's Brigham Young or, you know, Paul after Christ or whoever is going to, either the religion is going to survive because of the successor, or it's going to perish because the charismatic founder is now gone. David Miscavige did save Scientology when he got the tax exemption. And the church would not exist if it weren't for that. However, the church is in disarray now, and in part because of the behavior that he's exhibited according to many of my sources. So I think that it is now time for the church to examine those. Thank you. Last question.
I'm wondering if you could talk about their hatred of psychiatry and the things they've done involving that.
The psychiatry, you could say this psychiatry drives them nuts. L. Ron Hubbard, when he wrote Dianetics, he was under the illusion that he was going to be acclaimed by the American Psychological Association and the American Psychiatric Association. He sent the manuscript to them for their imprimatur, and they laughed at him. In the viewpoint of scientists, this is like psychological folk art. You know, who would take this seriously? You know, what are these studies that he's citing, but there's no evidence that they actually exist? And his intuition that he drew upon to imagine human behavior was something that in the field of psychiatry was seen as incredibly naive and disturbing. So ever after that, Hubbard left no opportunity to attack psychiatry. But it was more than that. He alleges that psychiatry is at the root of all human ills. And everything, terrorism, racism, genocide, psychiatrists are behind it. When Tom Cruise jumped down Matt Lauer's throat about Brooke Shields and said, "You don't know the history of psychiatry, Matt, I do." What he's referring to is that. He's referring to Hubbard's belief that 4 trillion years ago, which is in the Scientology calendar about when the universe began, psychiatrists were there. And when Xenu, the evil galactic overlord, who is responsible for so much damage, he was surrounded by psychiatrists, and they came up with a plan to because they were overpopulated in the galaxy at the time, to bring in the surplus population, supposedly for tax audits. Freeze them, send them in rocket ships that resemble DC-3s to the prison planet TGAC, which is Earth, and drop them in volcanoes and blow them up and with nuclear bombs, and then capture their disembodied spirits and re-educate those spirits by putting them in front of movie screens and showing them images of England and thoughts about Jesus and the Catholic Church and so on. And so that's where we all kind of come from. But it's psychiatrists that are behind all this. So in brief, that's the relationship of the Church of Scientology and psychiatry. Thank you very much.
I got a home in Tennessee. That's the place I wanna be. Don't you rock, don't you rock, don't you rock, don't you rock, daddy, oh. Ever I get my new house done, give my old one to my son. Don't you rock, don't you rock, daddy, oh, rock, my daddy, oh, don't. Sail away, lady, sail away. You'll be an angel by and by. Sail away, lady, sail away. Don't you rock a daddy-o, don't you rock a daddy-o. Don't you rock a daddy-o, don't you rock a daddy-o.
And now for something completely different.